Thank you to Wildcare and Wildlife Acoustics for sponsoring the Bat Chat podcast.
Can you hear that? We can. Wildlife Acoustics creates the world's leading bat acoustic monitoring tools, designed to help scientists make impactful discoveries for our biologically diverse planet, turning this into this. Visit wildlifeacoustics.com to learn more.
Wildcare are committed to supporting the ecology industry and are specialists in supplying a large range of monitoring, conservation and habitat management products, as well as equipment hire and service and repair. With a large range of products coupled with friendly and expert help and advice, Wildcare is a favourite supplier for ecologists nationwide. Go to wildcare.co.uk to see the full range and quote BatChat at the checkout for 10% off all bat detectors and bat boxes. Hello and welcome back to Bat Chat, the podcast from the Bat Conservation Trust. I'm Steve Rowe. Here at BCT, we have a vision of a world rich in wildlife, where bats and people thrive together. And my guest this week is helping achieve that vision, one garden at a time. Recorded in mid-October at the top of a sloping meadow in Northamptonshire while socially distanced, I chatted to Joel Ashton, sat underneath huge sycamore trees with two mature hedgerows running either side of us down to a private house at the bottom of the meadow where Joel's team were busy constructing a wildlife pond. So it's mid-October and I've had a short drive down to Daventry in Northamptonshire and I'm with Joel Ashton, otherwise known as one of the Butterfly Brothers from Hazelwood Landscapes. Joe, do you just want to introduce yourself and what the company does?
Yeah, so I have spent effectively the last 15 years designing and installing habitats for wildlife, and it's something that has become a lot more commonplace, I think, nowadays, which is obviously great for business, but first and foremost, it's more important for the wildlife. So I now travel around the country with my team of guys who do some long hours, but it's all for the benefit of wildlife in the end. So yeah, and then that's effectively my job. And Hazelwood Landscapes are obviously the limited company that I set up in 2005 to carry out these works and to help make the habitats for wildlife.
And is the work more to do with private landowners, or do you work for all sorts of different people?
So it's a bit of a mix, really. I'd say probably 80% are domestic clients, so people like yourself or somebody with a small terrace garden in central London, or it might be somebody with who's fortunate enough to, like this, for example, to have a couple of acres. But also, I do work a lot with people like the Wildlife Trust, RSPB, Butterfly Conservation, so help, you know, either maintain habitats or create new habitats. So, and that's obviously a little bit more landscape scale a lot of the time. But a bit of a varied mix, really, but mostly domestic.
So the theme for today's podcast is telling our listeners how they can welcome bats into their own gardens or green spaces that they might have at home. You're working on this private dwelling down in Northamptonshire. Can you just want to tell us what we're doing down at the bottom here?
Yeah, so we were contacted to effectively create a wildflower meadow, and it sort of went from there, really. So we now have ended up creating some steps through a little woodland walk, which will effectively be planted up with native herbaceous perennials, native shrubs, and there's a wildlife pond as well we're doing now, which will be obviously a fantastic resource for bats and lots of other life. I've had a grey wagtail rather frustrated flying around waiting for us to get out of the picture so it can come down and have a wander around the edges, which is great. They're already ready to move in. And effectively, then there's about probably a quarter of an acre or there or thereabouts of wildflower meadow just wrapping around that, and which will then spread into this wider field, which of course will be a great hunting ground for the local barn owls, kestrels and everything else. So yeah, a field edge project, garden into field edge, if you like. And we're surrounded by these wonderful mature trees, as you can see. We've got some fantastic, really, really old oak trees, sycamores, mixed deciduous woodland, and these brilliant hedgerows, of course, which are unmanaged. And now that the current landowners of this property are looking after these hedges, of course, they won't be flailed every year. And as you can see now, mid-October, full of berries, great for the red wings and the field fares, which I've just started hearing in the last couple of days coming in over the field. So yeah, it's a really nice mix of habitats around here, and hopefully the pond and the wildflower meadow down the bottom will be the epicentre of it.
It's not your typical garden, is it? It's fairly large.
I'm only slightly envious.
And I mean, we've mentioned ponds there a couple of times, and when people talk about wildlife gardening and when you see it on Springwatch and Autumnwatch, the one thing they always mention is a pond. Mm. What is it about ponds that are the key thing for wildlife?
They're just such an amazing resource. I mean, you name any species in this country, it will rely on water. You know, so whether that is a wood mouse coming down for a drink, whether that's a hedgehog, grey wagtail that I've just mentioned, obviously dragonflies, damselflies, frogs, toads, newts, all the kind of normal associated animals that you would see or expect to see around a pond. But it's everything really. And the things as well, like bees, you know, I see many bees in some of the wildlife ponds I'm creating, just sat there on one of the lily pads, you know, having a drink. And you don't think about that in terms of a bee's life cycle, but of course they do take on water. So that's great. And of course, all the wildflowers around the margins. So things like purple loosestrife, ragged robin, your greater bird's foot trefoil, hemp agrimony, they're all brilliant for all the insects, you know, so the butterflies, moths, bees, hoverflies and everything else. So effectively, you can have a mini wildflower meadow around the margins. You've got the water for all your invertebrates as well. So things like pond skaters, or your dragonfly larvae, damselfly larvae, of course, for that part of their life cycle. And then, of course, for bats, which we can't forget. And, of course, a lot of the food that bats will eat will be mosquitoes. So, of course, I think it's 2,000 to 3,000 a night they can eat, isn't it? Something phenomenal like that. So of course, a pond, any pond, is going to produce mosquito larvae if it's near some sort of trees or some sort of cover. And, of course, the bats will then gorge upon this during the evening. So, yeah, they're just an amazing source of life. And so you can't really beat them.
And you say any pond, can they literally be any size as well?
They can. I mean, obviously, the smaller you go, the harder it is for the bigger larvae of, you know, some of our bigger dragonflies, sort of emperors, southern hawkers, that sort of thing. The dragonfly, the nymphs, if you like, which can sometimes be 2 or 3 years in this form before they emerge as adult dragonfly, they're going to eat a lot, put it simply. They are voracious eaters, so they will get through a fair lot of invertebrates. So obviously the smaller you go, the less food there is for them, so the less likely you are going to be able to sustain a population of them, of course. But any water body is better than no water body. And I get so many people come to me and say, look, I've only got a balcony or a courtyard garden, what can I do? And I will almost instantly say, get yourself a wildlife barrel or a little barrel pond. And I've done a little video on my YouTube channel, which if anyone's interested is Wild Your Garden with Joel Ashton, after the book, of course. And that is, there's a little how-to on there. And the amount of people I get saying, oh, there's dragonflies and damselflies coming to inspect, you know, literally a week after it's gone in the garden, you know. I mean, I've got two on my patio. I've got a little wildlife pond as well, but I've got two on my patio. And God alone knows how the newts and the frogs get into them, because they're quite steep-sided, you know. But they do. There's always a little frog on one of the lily pads, or, you know, so that even a barrel pond, and of course the beauty of a barrel pond is you haven't got to dig it out the ground if you move house. You know, you can, you know, empty it, take the contents in a couple of buckets, and away you go. So yeah, even a barrel pond can be, you know, a fantastic source for a lot of life.
And a lot of the advice out there that talk about gardening for bats say that it's key that the flowering plants you put in are night flowering. What are your preferred night flowering plants when you're doing gardening?
So the Nicotiana, a very good one. Tobacco plants, obviously very good.
I've just bought some of those seeds this autumn, good, ready for next year.
Yeah, yeah. Generally, I've found white flowering plants are very good. Mm. So things like Hebes, for example, and of course, night-scented stocks as well. But in general, I mean, buddleias as well. I know it's a little bit controversial. A lot of people say, oh, they're invasive. But, you know, I think managing a garden setting, they're fine. And buddleias are fantastic. I mean, I've always got silver wire moths, you know, visiting the buddleias every year in the garden. And so they're really good. And, of course, your day-flying moths as well. Things like, you know, your hummingbird hawk moths are going to love things like valerian, red valerian, that is. But going back to your question, I think on the night side of things, yeah, certainly white flowered plants I've found do work very well. And the two or three species I've just named are probably the better ones, I would say.
Okay. And what about climbing plants? Are they a good way to transform things like fences into habitats as well?
Definitely, yeah. I'm a big advocate, I'd like to think, for these. They're one of my favourite habitats, actually, because, of course, so many people, well, nearly everybody who's got a garden has got a fence. And just by adding some simple trellising or a bit more of a kind of a bespoke structure. Oh, obviously, please check if the fence is yours first. I don't want you to get any trouble with the neighbours. But fences are a brilliant way of including some vertical habitat in your garden. And not only is it great for your nesting birds, blackbirds, robins, song thrushes, dunnocks, you know, it's also good, of course, as you suggest, for having some flowering varieties growing up there. So things such as honeysuckle, winter flowering jasmine. Honeysuckle, of course, is a real favourite for a lot of the hawk moth species. So obviously hawk moth is a rather tasty snack for a bat. So not that it's nice to think of a fabulously fresh hawk moth being munched. And actually, I've seen them before. I've actually heard on nights when it's, you know, you just get these nights sometimes in the year, don't you, when you see that, you know, a certain species will just come out in vast number. And I've actually heard bats crunching overhead the wing cases, or the wings and the wing cases of insects, you know, unfortunately. And I've actually had hawk moth wings landing next to me. But it's all part of it, you know, and I think that. So honeysuckle is a brilliant one. Obviously, you've got things like old man's beard. And I really, really like the... forgive my pronunciation on this one. I believe it's Trachylospermum jasminoides, which is a star jasmine, as it's known. And that's a really strong scent in the evening. And so that is a good one for moths as well. But again, like I say, honeysuckle is a bit hard to beat, really, because it does obviously give off a lot of scent for insects, particularly, and it's stronger in the evening. So yeah, definitely use that. And I guess I say, you know, why would you rather look at a fence other, you know, compared to a green living wall, which could be teeming with life? So yeah. Definitely, if you can, get some trellising on those fences and get planting some climbers.
I had a moth trap out this year because during lockdown I started doing moth trapping and realised I was very much putting on a buffet for the bats. So yeah. I had all these moths coming in thinking, oh no,
that's
you
it.
See the moth wings.
That's exactly when I've seen them. Yeah, it's a bit disheartening, isn't it? But all part of it.
And if people have got large gardens, are there any trees or shrubs which are better than others? And if people are thinking about their own gardens, where are the best places to plant trees and shrubs?
Well, so obviously the whereabouts is important because, of course, you don't want to plant an oak tree 3 foot from your back door. But, you know, all in moderation. And, of course, great trees for all round. I mean, one of my favourite all round trees is the rowan because, of course, you've got a fantastic display of flowers in the spring. And then, of course, you've got these beautiful colours this time of year when the leaves are turning sort of yellows and oranges. And but on top of that, of course, you've got all the berries. So, and I've, you know, quite often... each year I will see, if I'm fortunate, maybe once or twice on my travels around the country, to see a flock of waxwing, you know, gorging on the berries. And obviously they're very good for our thrush species as well, blackbirds, song thrushes, missile thrushes, and the fieldfares and redwings again that are coming in from Scandinavia now. So rowan is a really good one. Crabapple's good as well, obviously doesn't get too big. But even silver birch, I mean, silver birch is a very much a pioneer species. And obviously it'll soon colonise a waste site. You know, if you see an old abandoned car park or something, silver birch is no doubt coming up in the cracks. But they are really good. There's a lot of associated moth species, particularly the larvae of which will feed on the leaves. But goat willow, you know, the pussy willow, some people might know it, is brilliant for moth larvae. And again, so by providing that habitat for the moths and the caterpillars, you are then in turn obviously providing food for the bats. So yeah, goat willow, I would say, is probably one of the better ones, certainly, yeah.
Lots of people in the last couple of years have started this thing called the No Mow May Challenge. Why is May the key month for not mowing? And if people want to stop mowing for longer, when are the best months to take a cut?
So, yeah, I mean, I think it's a great initiative and it's one we should all be doing, really. I mean, the amount of people that I've seen on Twitter or have contacted me to say, I put the mower in the shed, padlocked it, you know, and I didn't have to use it through the whole month of May. And the results were astounding, you know, because a lawn in many instances will probably already house things like birdsfoot trefoil, yarrow, red clover, you know, and these are all brilliant nectar sources for our bees and moths and butterflies. So by not mowing, you're giving these plants a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. You know, some of them may be there, you know, dormant, waiting to flower for, you know, 3 or 4 years, but just not had the chance because, of course, it's always mown. And by doing that, of course, you're inviting the bees and the other pollinating insects into the garden. So it's a brilliant thing. And I think, obviously, I'm slightly biased. I would have a path mown through the middle and that's it, you know.
Yeah.
But if you can, obviously, you know, mow for, and if you don't want it to, you know, last forever, then you keep it mown up until May. Don't mow through May. And then into June as well, because by the time you get to July, a lot of the species of wildflowers, of course, are going over. There's still a few coming out, so, you know, scabious and yarrow and things, they'll go on into September, of course. But if you can, you know, and you've got a portion of the garden that you're fed up of trundling up and down with a mower behind or in front of you, then obviously just let it grow. You'd be amazed what comes up. And this can, in turn, obviously bring a lot more life into the garden. And with those insects comes the birds and, you know, the mammals as well. And, yeah, it can be a really nice thing. So, you know, so May through to July, really, you know, and then mow it in August if you want to, when things are sort of tailoring off, obviously. But generally speaking, the wildflower meadows that I create and manage they're left all year. Apart from the September time, this time of year, we've just finished our last hay cut on one of our sites of the week. But any time, you know, September through to mid-October really is the ideal time to get your hay cut and collected. It frustrates me somewhat, and I won't go down this path, you know, it's a little bit controversial, but I know the management regimes for a lot of verges is a big bugbear of mine, because you know we have them near me. There's some triple SI verges which are full of, I mean, everything, you know, grating knapweed, marjoram, agrimony, birdsfoot trefoil, red clover, field scabious, grating knapweed, lesser knapweed. So they're just an absolute block of colour in July, and then you see it flailed the next week and there's nothing there, and you think, that was alive, it had marble whites on it last week, it had gatekeepers, you know, and it just, yeah, that's I won't go down that route today, but that, you know, for me is a big thing that we need to address as a country, because I've seen some of the way that verges are managed in France, for example, and other countries in Europe, and there's a greater sensitivity, I think, towards how these verges are managed, because unfortunately now a lot of the wildflower strips in the country are literally down the verges, and that's it. You know, yeah. 97% of our wildflower meadows have gone in the last 100 years. So it's an alarming amount of habitat, you know, and I think where we can protect these last remaining strips, and they're great corridors as well, you know, for things to move. And that's key, is keeping this connectivity, you know, so it's okay having a wildlife habitat here in this field. But unless it can travel, you know, populations become isolated. And then, of course, you get, you know, declines and things like house sparrows, of course. I think once they get below about 10 in a flock, they stop breeding altogether. So unless you've got that habitat for them to feed on those insects that are around those wildflowers, they are going to diminish, or they're just going to simply move on. So it's kind of a bit chicken in the egg. You know, you've got to have the wildflowers for the insects, but, you know, which in turn brings in the birds and everything else. So, yeah, I can't emphasize enough how important it is for us to all have a little bit of, even just a 10 square meter patch wildflower meadow. And you'd be amazed at even how much wildlife that can bring. They are a great little resource. So closely followed in second place behind the pond, I would say.
I mean, I've certainly noticed my Twitter feed over the last couple of years when people have walked along the country lanes, particularly in lockdown again, when people were out more and noticed that their local verges have been mown at the wrong time of year, and there's a lot of outcry out there at the moment.
Yeah, and unfortunately, and I don't like to name drop, but a lot of it is down to, for example, Natural England's, you know, guidelines, which I do think need addressing, because, you know, if you're mowing flowers that are in full flower with insects on them, where's the sense in it? You know, it is nonsensical, really. We don't need reminding of the insect declines that are going on at the moment. There's enough in the news about it. And, you know, you've only got to watch one of David Attenborough's documentaries to understand the problems the world's facing without mowing flowers when they're in full bloom. So, yeah, that's one that needs addressing, I think, but further thought on needed on that.
And lots of people ask me about putting up a bat box in the garden. Which is more important, the box itself or the garden?
Well, they sort of go hand in hand, really. And, of course, you know, it's okay having the garden, but if you haven't got the habitat for them to roost in, then they're not going to stick around. And, of course, they will travel, and you'll probably know a bit more on the distances they'll travel a night than I do. What, have you got any ideas on that? Or?
It depends on the species. So long-eared will travel 1 or 2 kilometres from a roost, whereas Dorbentons have been recorded 30-plus kilometres from the roost. So it depends on the species.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, because there was pipistrelles here. Unfortunately, I've been working late enough to see them last few nights. Which has been very nice, actually. And we've had lots of tawny owls in the trees behind us. But you know, they've been hunting along the edge of this tree line, which is obviously great for them. And of course, bats will hunt, you know, along tree lines and hedge lines for all those insects lifting off those associated trees and shrubs. And I should imagine they'll be in the sort of the big bits of flaking bark on some of these big sycamores and, you know, any sort of nooks and crannies, perhaps in the ivy as well, where it's denser. So there's some good habitat here for them. But in a garden setting, you know, I think the important thing is to have them both. They're both equally as important. So by putting up what's classed as a Kent style bat box, which is the best style you can put up in a back garden, from my experience anyway. Some people may have other ideas, but a Kent bat box is a fantastic way. I think they're 15 mil cavity for obviously the pipistrelle species, to get inside and to roost in. And I've actually seen, you know, three or four of them in some of the boxes during the daytime, which is brilliant, you know. And they wouldn't be there because, of course, now, unfortunately, all our building methods are so efficient, you know, for the warmth and everything else. You know, everything's sealed up and you can't, you know, there's no tiles sliding off the roof anymore like some of the older sort of, you know, Victorian or Georgian houses. And all our fascias and soffits are, you know, almost like hermaphrodically sealed, you know. It's just like they can't get in. So of course loft spaces, which of course they used to a lot of the time, are diminishing. And you know, so the more you can put up these Kent style bat boxes, and often in, you know, groups, I often put them up in threes or fours. And one of your other colleagues, Lisa, I did a lot for her. And yeah, I'm looking forward to going back to see that develop, because, you know, the boxes there look fantastic. You know, I think people get a bit little bit worried about how boxes look on houses, but, you know, forget what the neighbours think. It's about the wildlife.
Yeah.
And of course, so you would want to put them, I think it's 3 to 4 metres up, isn't it, for you know, most of them to be able to get a good flight path in and out. And so on. And again, as opposed to bird boxes, which is north and east facing, you'd want them either south or west facing, so that they are, you know, they like to stay warm during the day, of course. So so south or west facing, 3 or 4 metres up, I think is a great thing you can do. But then again, you've got to have the habitat for them to feed on. So, you know, once your boxes are up, think about your ponds, you know, think about your hedge lines, think about getting some structuring that's going to attract them, to going to provide insects, provide food, and then hopefully they'll stick around. They'll move in, and because they're great wanderers as well, and you know, they are a bit of a they are pioneers in finding new habitats as well. They can move about a bit, a lot like butterflies and bees, of course. So, you know, it is a case of if you build it, you know, they will come eventually. Don't expect brown long-eared or, you know, any some of the rarer species just to turn up, but certainly the pipistrelles, they're nearly in every garden I make, you know, around the country. So yeah, they are a good one to attract, and great for keeping the mosquito population down as well.
I'm glad you said Kent bat boxes, because they're the ones I tend to recommend, because they're so much easier to check. People can just check them from the ground without getting the ladder out.
No, they're great. And of course, you're not supposed to disturb them, you know, when they are nesting and everything. But, you know, I think a quick look is fine. And it's nice to know, because, you know, you wouldn't know if it's working or not unless you are checking. But of course, if anybody is worried, then of course they can get in touch with you guys, can't they, whether they have got to find out whether they've got bats or not.
All local bat groups.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And what's the one thing that makes you groan when you walk in somebody's garden and you think, oh no, why have you done that?
AstroTurf.
Yeah.
Biggest problem in the world, I think, that, you know, forget climate change, AstroTurf's the main issue. Well, it's part of it, isn't it? Yeah, really. It's, God, I can't stand that stuff. You know, it actually makes my toes curl up when I see it, you know. The really, really poignant moment of this summer for me was when I walked into a garden in South London, and the couple who've just moved in luckily want to completely start again, but it was pretty much just AstroTurf, you know, wall to wall. And I was just walking from the front of the garden to the back of the garden, not sure why, because there wasn't much else to look at, but you know, and I actually saw a little grasshopper right in the middle, about July time, right in the middle of this AstroTurf. And I thought, well, if that's not a message in itself, you know, that, and I actually did a tweet about it and said, well, are we eventually going to need plastic insects? Because, you know, everything in our life seems to be going that way. And I think that is such a huge, huge environmental problem, really, because it's not only just the installation of it in the loss of grass, you know, grass as a habitat. Okay, a mown lawn isn't brilliant, but it still provides, you know, feeding potential for starlings, for example, you know, where you might have the leather jackets, you know, the daddy long-nosed grubs in the grass, which of course they love to eat, you know, and ants and everything else, but it's far better than AstroTurf. And then secondly, it's the disposal of it. So when someone's had enough of it and they don't want to maintain it and it looks, you know, rubbish after a few years, it's then just plastic chucked in landfill. So yeah, I don't think I could top AstroTurf, to be fair. yeah, the one thing that really kind of lifts my spirits is probably when I go in and see a path through the lawn, you know, mown through the lawn, because, you know, nine out of 10 gardens, at least probably 9.9 out of 10 gardens across the country will no doubt have mostly mown lawns, which is something we need to reverse, because when you walk into a garden that has meadow or just long grass, and you can hear grasshoppers. I mean, how many people listening to this now can say they've heard grasshoppers in the garden or seen a grasshopper? In my last house, I left a strip about a foot wide around the edges. I've got two kids and two dogs. So in my last house, my views have changed. I now think, you know, it doesn't matter what the kids need, the wildlife anymore. They've got parks for that. So my house now has got a pond and a wildflower meadow, and that's it. There is no grass. It is just meadow, herbaceous borders, pond, and a path through it. But you know, I left 18 inches of my last house just around the edge, and it was only a terraced house with a long sort of typical narrow garden. Within a couple of weeks, there were grasshoppers around the edges, and that to me was such an achievement. And I'd not done anything; I'd simply not mown it, you know, and they were there living in the long grass. So I think to have areas of long grass even in your garden is fantastic. And every time I walk into a garden, and it's not often, not before I've done a garden anyway, it's not often, but every now and again, I just walk into one and think, oh, look at this. It's, you know, where you've got knapweed, where there would be just mown grass, or marjoram popping up, oxeye daisies, you know, it's a blaze of colour. And it's just, I think that it's just one of the best things in this country to see in my eyes. And I'm sure a lot of people will associate the thought and the sight of a wildflower meadow as one of the most bucolic images you can think of, really. But unfortunately, yeah, they're not as commonplace as they used to be.
And I mean, we're recording this in mid-October, and people listening to this, we're going to be later into the year. Are there any time, can you do your gardening or start planning for wildlife at any time of year?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's you know, there's I don't know this Japanese proverb, which is the best time to plant a tree was 30 years ago. The second best time is now, you know, which is very true. You know, I mean, you can sit and think about it and as much as you like, but just get on with it. You know, whatever you do, there's going to be a little bit of disturbance. You know, obviously you wouldn't want to go rooting through log piles in wintertime, because of course you might be disturbing a hedgehog or some newts or toads. But whatever you do, you know, summertime, you've got nesting birds. You've just got to be mindful of what's going to likely be in the habitats that are in the garden already. Unless you're walking into a new build, of course, and you've just got turf, you know, wall to wall to a fence. But really, the best time probably is, you know, now, as you're coming into autumn. You know, you can start thinking about maybe getting some of the garden cut back and cleared back. You know, as long as there's no birds obviously nesting now, apart from maybe the odd pigeon. you know, so autumn is a very good time, and of course that gives you a great opportunity now to buy, or from November on, to buy any bare root trees and shrubs. And when I say bare root, I obviously mean, you know, without the soil, which of course, you know, brings the cost down quite a bit, as opposed to buying potted and containerized trees and shrubs. So putting in bare root trees and shrubs, you know, from November through till sort of the end of March, is a great way of just literally getting some habitat in there and plant them as whips. You know, I've planted 2-foot whips on many jobs before. One I did in Peterborough a few years ago, and within 4 years it had matured into a hedgerow and it had breeding yellowhammers in it. And that was, I mean, that was on the edge of a field. So, you know, I'm not saying you'll get yellowhammers in the middle of a city, but you'll certainly get house sparrows and dunnocks and robins and blue tits and long tailed tits moving through. So, you know, plant them as whips and you'll be amazed. Quite often people think, right, I'll plant as big as I can afford, which is fine. But in my experience, you know, you can buy a 12-foot tree and it will sit there for 3 years. Because I kind of use the analogy, it's a bit like giving a hip replacement to a 20-year-old or an 80-year-old. You know, if you plant it when it's younger, it'll take a lot better to that. And they will shoot up. I mean, my last house, I planted some silver birch trees, or a silver birch tree, at 4 foot. And within 5 years, by the time I'd left, it was 20 foot. And it was its own, it looked like a tree, you know, it wasn't just like a shrub anymore. So they're very quick at establishing, you know, all it needs a bit of water to get them going. But of course, planting now is the perfect time. October is, you know, pretty much the month for planting. You know, things can get settled, they can get a little bit of growth on before the autumn. If it's a herbaceous, they can get a bit of root down again, if it's trees, shrubs and that sort of thing. And then they're there, then they're ready for the spring. Sometimes if you wait and wait and wait until sort of April time, unfortunately, you know, with the weathers, the seasons that go in the way they are, things can get quite dry quite quickly. You know, March and April can be, on paper and have been, you know, pretty warm in the past, and people have had to water. So, you know, I think now is a brilliant time. While there's still a little bit of warmth in the soil and the air, get your trees and shrubs in and start planting the rest of the garden.
And if people just want to do one thing to encourage bats to their garden, what's the one thing that you would do?
Can I say two?
Yeah.
So I'd put up some boxes, as we just said, for one, obviously some Kent bat boxes. But the best habitat you can possibly put in a garden is obviously a pond. I don't think you would have had to second guess me saying that, but they are just brilliant. And obviously for the bats, the mosquito larvae and the insects that they attract. I actually once was filling up a pond in Hereford a couple of years ago, and the same evening, while the tap was running, obviously sometimes have to use tap water rather than, you know, rainwater, unfortunately. But while the tap was running and the pond was filling up, there were two pipistrelles came in, started circling the pond, and it wasn't even half full, you know. So, and they were actively hunting over the water because there was already a few insects attracted to it. So it's phenomenally quick, you know. So definitely, without fail, pond. You know, nothing else. If you can't do anything else, you don't got room for anything else, or the finances for anything else, stick a pond in, definitely, yeah.
So it's time to plug yourself. You've got a book out. What's that all about?
So the book is Wild Your Garden, and as you can probably guess, it's about how to install all the features that you could possibly need in a garden. So your shrubs and trees, wildflower meadow, your wildlife pond, your herbaceous borders for your pollinators, and everything in between, all the icing on the cake, things like, you know, your hedgehog holes, insect hotels, you know, log piles, and everything to go with that. So, and it's a how-to. So it was written with Dorling Kindersley, and I think it's really nice to have that as a resource for people. A lot of people that have bought it have said, I love the fact I can pick it up, read about ponds, put it down, go and build one, and that's it, you know. And in the back of the book, there's a whole list of every single tree, shrub, plant, wildflower, pond plant you would ever need for each individual situation. So whether you've got heavy clay soils, sandy soils, what plants to put in your pond, your oxygenating plants, what herbaceous perennials you should use for attracting bees, what larval food plants we should use for common blue butterflies. So it's got all of that in the back, which I often refer to myself, if I'm honest, when I'm coming up with planting plans, because I forget half of them half the time. So Wild Your Garden, as I say, and it's available any sort of reputable bookstore, online, and all the usual places. Hopefully it will help a lot of people.
We'll stick a link to it in the show notes under the podcast. And if people want to follow you on social media, what are your handles?
At @butterfly_bros is the Butterfly Brothers page, and also myself @_JoelAshton, and obviously the website is hazelwoodlandscapes.com, where we've got a whole host of case studies and all the sort of projects we do, but I do a lot on YouTube as well. So Wild Your Garden with Joel Ashton, and again, that has got a lot of sort of how-to videos and, you know, little sort of short videos on how to attract different species of wildlife, some of the projects we've done, and everything in between. So hopefully between Twitter, YouTube, Instagram, I can't keep up these days, but all that lot, yeah. and hopefully I should have some exciting news shortly about an online website which will be available for anybody looking to buy any of the sort of garden, wildlife garden associated products. So, you know, ponds, liners, wildflowers, that sort of stuff as well. So stay tuned.
Well, I've taken enough of your time this afternoon, so I'll let you get back down the meadow to the pond at the bottom. Thank you very much, Joel.
Thank you very much. Pleasure.
And that's it for this week. Next time, we're going international and meeting renowned bat scientist Dr. Winifred Frick, who, amongst other things, was the first person to discover a new ecological behaviour in bats in the desert. So join us in 2 weeks, and in the meantime, hit that subscribe button so that the next episode downloads straight to your phone or tablet automatically. Now, lots of you have seen me in branded t-shirts and hoodies with the Bat Chat logo on, and you've all been asking me when they'll be available. Well, we're thrilled to let you know that a whole range of Bat Chat clothing and tote bags is now available for you on our T-Mill store. The link's in the show notes. Whether you're a long-time supporter or a new member of the Bat Chat family, we can't wait for you to share your photos of you wearing our merch on social media. Be sure to tag the Bat Conservation Trust in your posts. If you're listening to Bat Chat on Google Podcasts, we wanted to let you know that Google have announced they plan to discontinue their app later this year. So we recommend making the switch to an alternative podcast app, and we've put some links in the show notes to alternative apps that you can follow Bat Chat on so that you don't miss any future episodes.